I want to start this morning by talking about sin. The passage Linda just read is actually about sin. It may not have sounded like it, but if you back up just a little bit, you find out what's been going on in Isaiah is all the people feel like they're suffering and they're calling out to God and saying, "How long, God? Where are you? Why?" And so God says, "Well, I can tell you why you're suffering. It's because of what you have been doing. But when you stop doing what you have been doing and get your act together, then I am going to do this." And God goes on to set forth this incredible vision of the city on the hill. But it all starts with sin, so I want to talk to you about sin. This is what medieval theologians said sin was like. They said it was like a constant turning in upon oneself, a constant wrapping up into a little ball as you look deeper and deeper and deeper into yourself. They said it was like just talking about your own needs and your own desires and all the ways that you think the world has wronged you all day long while you get tighter and tighter and tighter into a little ball. This is what they said virtue was. This is what they said the Christian life was. They said it was a constant turning outward, a constant opening up, a flowering, a straightening of the back, a raising of the head, a focusing of your eyes on the places where God focuses. It's about learning to see the world the way God sees the world, seeing beauty where God sees it, seeing brokenness where God sees it, and then going right there to do something about it. They said this mattered because of what heaven was like. They said that heaven was just like what Isaiah said it was like. It was like a beautiful city on a hill. It was Jerusalem perfected. It was Boston the way Boston is supposed to be, and there was a great party going on there all day and all night, and everyone had enough to eat, and everyone had a place to stay, and there was no sound of mourning or wailing or crying or pain. And God answered your call before you even made it because you were living right in the heart of God already. And the city, it had walls around it, but there were a lot of gates in those walls, the pearly gates, you've heard of those. And there was no man on a high desk sitting outside those gates checking off people whether they could get in or whether they could get out. Those gates stood wide open all day and all night long, and anyone could go in. And when you die, you show up outside this city in the posture you had spent your life cultivating. If you had spent your life cultivating a straight-backed, clear-eyed posture, a flowering posture, an open posture, then you would appear outside this city and you would see it right there shining before you, and you would run through the gates right into God's heart. But if you had spent your life all curled up in a ball, staring at yourself and your own needs and your own desires, rehearsing over and over the litany of the ways your life had gone wrong, then you would show up outside heaven all curled up, and all you would see is yourself. And there would be people lining the walls, looking down on you, waving at you, trying to get your attention, yelling at you. They would be blowing trumpets at you to get your attention, but you would be mumbling too loudly to hear, and you wouldn't be able to uncrick your neck and see salvation right in front of you, and you would spend all eternity groveling in the dust, feet from the open doors of heaven. And that would be hell. When my son was born, when Terry's and my son was born, he had some medical problems and he was in a lot of pain, and so he spent the first days of his life in the neonatal intensive care unit. I don't know if you've ever been in one of these before, but they're pretty intense places. They're so dark, they're dim, they're hot, they're quiet. They want to make it as womb-like as possible for these little kids who have just been born and have something going on. And my son would lay there in this plastic bassinet, all swaddled up with wires coming out of the swaddling in every direction, going to all these machines that I didn't understand. And we would spend hours in this dimness with people padding around near us, and we could hear other families talking to other little babies, crooning to them, and we had no idea what we were supposed to be doing. We were as new as any new parents have ever been, so we couldn't deal with a healthy newborn, much less a sick one, but we were doing our best. And one day, I was holding Asa, and suddenly a machine started beeping loudly right next to me, and I didn't know what it was, and he started thrashing, really thrashing around in his Bunting, and his face squelched up and turned beet red, and he started screaming that little tiny baby scream way back in the back of his throat. And he was obviously very upset. Something was obviously very wrong, and I did not know what to do. And then out from behind the desk at the nurse's station came Tanya. I want to tell you that I will teach Tanya's name to my son his whole life long. And if they're not singing her name in heaven when I get there, I will teach it to them too. Tanya came around, and she came over, and she looked at the machine, and she looked down at Asa thrashing so hard, and she looked at our stricken faces, and she bent over him, and she went, "Oh, sweetie." And she ran her hand down his forehead. And under her hand, all those wrinkles disappeared, and his eyes closed, and he went peacefully to sleep. It's just the tiniest gesture. But I want to tell you that with that gesture, she saved the world. Or at least it felt like it to me. She fixed everything by just going, "Oh, sweet," and running her hand down. Just someone who knew what they were doing, touching my sick kid gently, fixed everything. And here's the thing, I'm sure she doesn't remember it. She may remember Asa, she may remember us, I doubt it, but I'm sure she doesn't remember that moment. You know why? She does 1,000 movements like that a day. She has made it routine to save the world. She has made it her business to get so good at fixing everything with a touch that she doesn't even remember all the times she does it. She could have chosen some other profession. She could have been an actor on the stage. She could have been a lawyer. She could have been a million other things. She chose to be a neonatal intensive care unit nurse. You don't do that accidentally. You don't just trip and become a nurse. You have to work hard. You have to practice hard to get that good at your job. Which I think is what the Christian life is about. Which I think is what we're celebrating on Christian Service and Outreach Sunday. We're talking about practicing saving the world. We're talking about getting so good at turning outward and seeing with God's sight that we don't even notice we're doing it half the time, that we can't even remember all the times we saved the world. That's what she did. That's what the Christian Service and Outreach Committee exists to call you to come to us when we are all curled up in a tight ball and say, "Hey, look. Look what's happening on Boylston Street and see it the way God sees it. Look what's happening at the State House and see it the way God sees it. Look what's happening in the newspaper. See it the way God sees it. Stand up, look out, and do something about it." The Outreach Committee wants you to think of them as your personal trainers. These muscles that double you over so easily, they're strong, but they want you to work out these muscles, the ones that straighten you up and send you looking out the way God looks. Because don't you have enough trouble? Don't you have enough worry? Don't you have enough wrong with any one day of your life to keep you rolled up in a ball for a year? Isn't there enough wrong with your kids or with your parents or with the economy or with your health or with your relationships to keep you curled up in bed staring at yourself and mumbling all day long? So we come to places like this and we have days like this to remind us to look hard and to stand up and to go. And to be like Tanya, and save the whole world with just a touch. Now you might say to me, "Quinn, she didn't save the world with just that touch. She just calmed a finicky newborn." You might say, "Quinn, that's all in your head. That was about your problems, not about anything she did." And I say to that, maybe. But you also might say, "You weren't saving the world with that bar of soap you brought in for the Church World Service hygiene kit drive. That was just one bar of soap." And to that I say, "Well, maybe. But I'm not going to make that judgment until I talk to the person in Vermont without a house who receives it. You might say, you weren't saving the world. You just spent 4 hours of your life cooking lunch for people at Sunday's Bread. And to that I say, maybe, but I'm not going to make that call until I talk to someone who ate that meal. You might say, you didn't save the world. You just hosted Women's Lunch Place for a summer. To which I say, maybe, but I'm not going to make that call until I talk to Linda Burstyn. You might say, you weren't saving the world. You just spent so many hours in a bunch of meetings. To which I say, maybe, but I'm not going to make that call until I talk to the woman whose child has health care coverage now because of what the Greater Boston Interfaith Organization did. You might say to me, Quinn, that's not saving the world. God saves the world. To which I say, well, you're right about that, but not alone. Here's what medieval theologians said that heaven would be like. They said it would be like Boston on a hill, perfected. And there would be a party there all day and all night. And there would be no mourning and no crying and no pain. And God would answer before you call, because you'd be living right in God's heart already. And there'd be a wall around the door, around the city with a lot of doors in it. And there'd be people on the walls. And when you die, you show up outside that city. And if you had spent your life straight-backed and clear-eyed, you'll see it right in front of you and run the gate. But if you have spent your life all curled up in a ball, you will show up that way and you will not know that you are feet from heaven, and you will not hear them yelling to you or see them waving on the walls. And that will be the only sorrow in all of heaven. That's what medieval theologians said. I want to tell you that that is not what heaven will be like. Heaven will be like a perfect city on a hill, and there'll be a party going on there, and there will be no cries from neonatal intensive care units there, and there will be no mourning and no crying and no pain, and people will build houses and inhabit them. They will not be repossessed. And God will answer your call before you make it, because you will live in the center of God, and there will be walls and there will be doors and there will be people on the walls, and those who show up clear-backed and straight-eyed will go through the doors, and those who show up in a ball on the ground will stay there for a time. But there is no sorrow in heaven. Here's why there's no sorrow in heaven. There are Christians there. They're not the only ones there, I'm sure of it, but some of the people in heaven are Christians, and they will have spent their lives looking out to see the world the way God sees it. They will have spent their lives with straight backs and clear eyes, and they will go wherever God goes, which is to say, where the suffering is, where the needy are, where the broken are. And when they get to heaven, they are not going to stop. So when they're on the walls and they see someone show up outside all curled up in a ball, they are not going to leave them there. They're going to get down off the damn walls, go out through the gate, and get them. They're going to bend down and they're going to say, hey, look right there. And if that doesn't work, they're going to get down on their knees. And you're going to put your arms around them. And you're going to say, oh, sweetie. And you're going to run your hand right down that furrowed brow until it is soft and smooth. And you're going to massage those backs until they can raise their heads just a little bit and see heaven shining in front of them. And then you're going to put their arm around your shoulder and stand up. And when you go back through those gates, you will not be alone. And this is the song you will be singing.